Hello, I'm Ryan Oxenberg. This is number 0203, the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0203. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet actress Brenda Dixon, who originated the character of Jill Abbott on The Young and the Restless. She talks about her book, My True Hidden Hollywood Story, and how she was fired from the show and blacklisted.
8 months after I was fired, I won Best Villainess, People's Choice Award. And so I was one of the most popular women in daytime, highest paid, and I couldn't get an agent in Hollywood. It was horrible. I sued him. My attorney worked for him. They colluded. He didn't tell me he was working for William Bell or the show. So this was all hidden, and they drug this trial out for 3 years, and they hid everything, told me not to do any interviews. So the public never knew what happened to me.
Laura Lee Rosano is a former addict turned family counselor. She's also the author of Jagged Little Edges. Lorelai says that alcohol itself is not the enemy.
You know, I don't think alcohol is the bad guy here. I mean, there's lots of folks who can drink, and then there's some who can't, like me. You know, addiction affects 1 out of 10. But if you took that ratio, that's pretty much everyone. Almost everyone knows someone suffering the effects from addiction, whether it's a person or a family member who loves someone. So I don't want to make alcohol the bad guy here, because I don't think alcohol is the bad guy, but there are some people who shouldn't be drinking it, me for one.
Carol Jean Delmar is the author of Serenade. It's a memoir of her parents' lives, starting in 1927 Vienna and going through the Holocaust era.
Being the daughter of Holocaust survivors and having written this book, which is a love story, really, about my parents, but describes their trials and tribulations and struggles during the Holocaust era, I believe stronger than ever in my life that I want to bring to light the events that occurred during the Holocaust so that we never forget.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0203, was filmmaker Ryan Oxenberg, who has started an interesting series of films on YouTube called Lifeline Booth, that dresses up a payphone in LA's Skid Row. Ryan will actually be on the show next week to talk about it, but this former Torontonian agreed to do the guest slate on this episode of the Stuff File program, and for that, we thank him very much. And by the way, you can go to the website at thestufffile.com and find the link to Ryan's film, which again is called Lifeline Booth. It's the first episode, many more to follow. And again, thank you very much, Ryan, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, and we will indeed talk to you on next week's show. And this, of course, is the Stuff File program, also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, when Tom Stillwell, age 20, woke up in a hospital, the British man, living in Auckland, New Zealand, was told what brought him there. He had arrived at his apartment after a night out with friends to discover he was locked out. Stillwell, who lives on the 14th floor of the building, knocked on the door of the woman who lived directly above him. Despite the hour, 2 a.m., and despite him being a little bit tipsy, Geraldine Batiste, age 28, let him in. Stillwell's plan: can you please let me jump off the balcony? I will not bother you, just let me use your balcony. He figured he could let himself into his apartment from his own balcony just below. I never really thought that he would do it, Batista said. In my mind, I thought, okay, I'll just let you see that it's really impossible. But, she said, without saying a word, he went over the rail and fell 13 stories to the roof of an adjacent building. He survived, believe it or not, with internal injuries and multiple fractures, including his back and neck. Once a nurse in intensive care explained what happened, she handed Stillwell a board and a pen. He couldn't talk, thanks to the tubes in his throat, so he wrote this reaction: what an idiot. Yeah, That's what he wrote. That's what he actually wrote. So you're probably wondering why he isn't this week's Idiot of the Day. Well, first of all, alcohol was used, and unfortunately, many smart people do idiotic things while under the influence. If I was to make every person do that in the Stuff File program an Idiot of the Day, I wouldn't have enough room. Plus, Tom himself recognizes that he was an idiot, or at least idiotic in this particular situation, and most idiots don't know they're idiots, so that gets Tom a pass. By the way, the Idiot of the Day will be coming up a little later on. Stick around for that. Moving right along, Harold Bashir Jr. of Louisville, Kentucky, was convicted of burglary after he broke into a neighbor's house and was ordered to pay $100 in restitution to the victim, Johnny Perry. Well, afterward, police say, Bashir saw Perry riding his bicycle and Bashir ran him over with his car. Now, Perry tried to run home, but Bashir caught up with him, beat him, and took his $100 back. Perry was treated at a hospital for his injuries, and Bashir was charged with endangerment, assault, and robbery. You know, I get the feeling this could go on for quite a while. It's not exactly a neighborhood situation, or at least a neighborly situation, unless, of course, you're the Hatfields and McCoys. A train conductor in Lorain, Ohio, called the police after he spotted a man involved in some, well, shall we say, individual stimulation. When they arrived, the police caught the 30-year-old man after a short chase. Then, and only then, it got weird. We noticed he had blood on his groin area, so we called Life Care, explained Detective Buddy Sivert. He was only wearing shoes and a pair of shorts. When the medic asked the man what had happened, the unnamed man said he cut off the offending body part with a hacksaw. Ooh. We found it nearby in the rocks by the tracks, said Detective Jack Morris. When asked why he had performed the unusual self-mutilation, he explained that, quote, George Bush made me do it, unquote. Police found nothing illegal or suspicious, but authorities say drugs may be a factor in the incident, you figure. Here's the quote of the year. I love this quote. His behavior, his speech, and the fact that he mutilated himself made us to believe it was possibly drug-related. Wow. There's a stretch, huh? If he wasn't on drugs before, he'll certainly need some now. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, this story, by the way, comes to us thanks of Bob Welsh at WDEV in Vermont. Thank you, Bob, for this one. An Oklahoma man who caught a burglar breaking into his home wasn't content to simply scare the criminal away. Instead, the man bum-rushed the burglar, pinned him to the ground, hog-tied him, and left him in the front yard for police to find because, well, the homeowner was late for work. The incident took place early Wednesday morning when the homeowner and his 9 months pregnant wife were awoken by the sound of shattering glass coming from their daughter's bedroom. The couple heard something in their garage, so the man went and waited patiently by their front door for the burglar to emerge. The homeowner then pinned the burglar, later identified as Robert Cole, to the ground and hogtied him, with Cole's hands and feet tied behind his back. The homeowner, whose name was not released, called 911 and then told his wife that he was going to work and that she should watch over the hogtied criminal until police arrived. Police arrived not long after the husband left. Cole was arrested and faces one charge of first-degree burglary. You know, I really would like to know what job he was going to that morning. I mean, he really had to be at work. This guy is as cool as a cucumber. That's all I'm saying. Anyway, shall we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program? Yes, let's do that. Brenda Dixon is best known for originating the role of Jill Abbott on The Young and the Restless, a character she played from 1973 to 1980, then again from 83 to 87. Brenda was fired from the show and blacklisted in Hollywood. So, what happened? Well, Brenda writes about it in her book, My True Hidden Hollywood Story, and she joins us on the line from L.A. Hi, Brenda.
Oh, it's nice to be here with you. Actually, I'm in California, but we're only a few miles away, right?
Absolutely. Now, as I said, you were last on the show in 1987. You've chosen to write this book now. Why wait?
Because I was a little bit afraid of the whole thing, and I remarried and moved to Hawaii. It was all hidden, the blacklisting and the blacklisting trial, and everything is hidden, and I put it in the book, my firing. I'd given a year's notice that I was leaving, by the way. I wasn't staying on the show. They fired me to ruin my reputation, because when I left the show, I had a seven-year contract. I married and left for 3.5 years, and during that time, the ratings fell 6 points, and when I came back, almost immediately, they came back up the 6 points, and they'd never reached, they remained low. Those 6 points were low. Maybe for a week they'd come up, but basically they were low the whole time I was gone. And there was my character had changed into a villainess, a multimillionaire villainess, which was fine with me because I'd married a multimillionaire, and Bell Bell followed my personal life, so he wrote that in too. And, he wanted the old character that he did, and he was living in Chicago, and a bunch of other people were running the studio at that time in Los Angeles, and they made it difficult for me to perform unless I did, you know, pretty much what they wanted, and I thought it was right anyway, because they had a whole new cast. They had Perry Lester, and they had all the Abbott family, and I thought it was best to be the villainess, because they needed that character in the family, and it just kept getting worse and worse, and I had signed a 3-year contract, and at the end of my contract, I said, you guys are fighting over me so much because I brought the ratings in. The ratings went up 9 points when I became a villainess, so 3 more points higher, and Bell Bell kept trying to sabotage that character and wanted his daughter to be a star on the show, and it just got out of control, and Jean was really ill. She was drinking just beyond, I mean, she was in blackouts and working, and the show was a mess because of these wars that went on in the show. So when I left, the ratings fell 9 points, and they never came back up, and Bell Bell blacklisted me, and I know this because a press agent sent me to William Morris, and William Morris called Bell Bell. This is how it works. And he said, don't hire her. She was a problem on her show. And so the agent gets back to my press agent and tells her off the record that, you know, they're not going to take me at William Morris because Bell Bell said not to. And this echoed all the way throughout Hollywood, and I couldn't get an agent. And 8 months after I was fired, I won Best Villainess, People's Choice Award, a Dick Clark special. And so I was one of the most popular women in daytime, highest paid, and I couldn't get an agent in Hollywood. It was horrible. I sued him. My attorney worked for him. They colluded. They didn't tell me. He didn't tell me he was working for William Bell or the show. He hired all the below-the-line people and did their contracts, my attorney, Mike Shelley. So this was all hidden, and they drug this trial out for 3 years, and they hid everything, told me not to do any interviews. So the public never knew what happened to me, and they Bell Bell, in one of the depositions, said, I hear you're looking for spouse support. And I said, how'd you know that? And he said, well, I'm getting my mouth done by your ex-husband, that was Robert Rifkin, a dentist. And so he began seeing my ex-husband, and before I knew it, my ex-husband was creating a completely false bankruptcy, laundering an income of $3 million through the federal bankruptcy court in L.A. It was the biggest mess with this guy. And so I married an attorney who took over the cases and moved to Hawaii, and he was about to, they let us out of the bankruptcy court with this case because the attorneys were involved in some foul play. And right before we went in to try it in Hawaii, it was actually in Los Angeles, but from Hawaii, he got a phone call, my ex-husband, Jan Weinberg, and he said, they threatened me, I can't try this case. And my popularity, oddly enough, and I think it was 2007, something like that, they released a film called Welcome to My Home, and almost immediately 3 million people viewed in, and so Sony Pictures took it off the airwaves, even though it was my film and I did it after they fired me. And so I carried with me an audience that was more audience than the actual show itself, which ended up being at best 5 million, mostly 4 million. But when I left, it was about 3 million. They were losing money.
Okay, so you've now.
I'm sorry, I'm probably talking too much.
So you've now written this book, My True Hidden Hollywood Story. And the thing I'm surprised about is I mean, you played Jill Abbott on a daytime soap, and daytime soaps are known for having wild and extravagant plot lines, and it sounds like the Brenda Dixon story is far more, shall we say, larger than life than anything Jill Abbott ever did.
Yes, it is. It's beyond your imagination, and the way that they treated the actors behind the scene on that show. I wrote those, you know, those chapters in, because that when you read the behind the scenes of the set, it was incredible. But my story, when they got into my story, it was horrible that they would remain in my life the way that they remained in my life. And they even kept track of my life in Hawaii and wrote things, and you know, it was like I was some sort of, they were playing games on the set.
Well, why do you think they were so vindictive? Because, you know, regardless of whatever the issues and problems you would have with the Bells and Sony and CBS, you know, actors.
Well, I don't think it was CBS. Maybe it was. I don't think it was, and I don't think it was Sony particularly. I basically think it was the Bell family, because what they did was so outrageously crooked in that trial. For instance, Laura Lee Bell went to my gynecologist. I was very, very ill when they illegally fired me. And he showed her the workups on a bladder infection that I had, and she hid that. All of this was hidden from the court. None of my witnesses or doctors or anybody ever hit the court for that. They hid everything from the judge, and Laura Lee Bell was in on it with her father. And the reason it meant so much to them is that Columbia Pictures said, hey, look, we're not going to represent you in this. You illegally fired her. You illegally blacklisted her. You're going to have to take it out of your pocketbook if you lose, and you're going to have to pay for everything yourself.
Okay, so
it all became very crooked because it was a lot of money to Bell Bell. It was an $11 million lawsuit.
Okay, so you have this battle with them. You go to you go to court. You now write this book. With
yeah.
all that has happened, that as you say has happened to you, vis-a-vis the Bells and what they've tried to do, blacklisting you and making sure you don't work. Aren't you worried about more repercussions now that you're getting the story out there?
No, I'm not, because I think the mistake that I made, and you know, so many girls in Hollywood have gone through this. One of the people that it worked out really well for was, say, for instance, Valerie Harper, who opened her mouth immediately. You know, the problem with me is that everything was hidden by my attorney, who actually worked for William Bell. So the problem was, is I everything was hidden because I had so much power. When they fired me, if I'd opened my mouth immediately, the audience would have, well, they clicked off anyway, even without me opening my mouth. But can you imagine? I mean, the show would have been over.
Mm.
And so I think it's better to open your mouth in a situation like this. I really do. And I'm still in my court cases. I'm here in L.A., still trying to get my half of the property from my last marriage that was you have to read the story, but the two marriages were done identically.
Okay.
They laundered all of the money to my ex-husbands. And the game was is that Bell Bell was supposed to be my ex-husband. You'll have to read the book to see how he wrote into these characters. For instance, Gene Cooper was a struggling alcoholic. Well, in real life, he was a struggling alcoholic, you understand. This man had games that he played with people's lives, and he liked to do it. So he decided he was just going to get into my life. There was some sexual harassment and blacklist and all that stuff in the book. So you have to read the book because it unfolds and to behind this man's mind, you know, and how he worked. And it's very fascinating.
Okay, so
it's a fascinating book, I must say. It turned out really well.
So Brenda, we got just about a minute left. I just got to ask, you know, you kind of had to, because of what happened to you, put your career on hold. Would you like to ratchet up your career again as an actress? And if so, what would you like to do?
Well, I don't know. I haven't really got to that point yet. I'm still in court with my ex-husband. I don't know what I'm going to do next. I'll probably do film or nighttime television series. I won't do another daytime. That's for sure. Too much. By the way, you can buy my book on www.BrendaDickson.com. You can order it there. We're doing the pre-sales, which will be out August 3rd. I received the hard copy, and they're selling like wild on Amazon and Barnes & Noble Nook and all the iPads. So if you want to buy a book, you can do it on my station, www.BrendaDickson.com, or any of the other electronic books. But the hard copy I'm selling on my book, and it will be on Amazon as well.
The book is called My True Hidden Hollywood Story. It's written by Brenda Dickson. And Brenda, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on with us.
It was just lovely talking to you, Peter. I'll maybe talk to you another time.
Actress Brenda Dickson. Once again, her book is called My True Hidden Hollywood Story. You can find the book on her website. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0203, and you'll find links to Brenda's site, plus also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
You're listening to The Stuff File program. It's the choice of 4 out of 5 dentists. The 5th dentist also listens, but that's just because he follows the crowd. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of Jagged Little Edges about addiction. Plus, the author of Serenade, as she talks about her parents' lives during the Holocaust period. But first, more stuff from the Stuff File news portion of the program here on the Stuff File program, which is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. A 71-year-old man in North Strayburn Township, Pennsylvania, became enraged after two cars pulled into his driveway. The two had been in a multiple car accident, and the drivers were apparently just trying to get them off the street. But the homeowner was so irate that the drivers called police for help. When officers arrived, the man allegedly fought them too, but calmed down after being handcuffed, officers say. Then the man said he was having a heart attack. The officers called for medics and took off the cuffs, but that only proved the cardiac was fake, and he started fighting with the cops again. Once they got him to the station, he pulled out his dentures and pulled off his watch and threw them both at the cops. William Moody was charged with resisting arrest, assault, and making terroristic threats. Well, the cops didn't really need his dentures or his watch because they already put the bite on him, and they have all the time in the world. He doesn't, though. But anyway, we move on. Our next story actually starts off with a quote from an attorney at a trial. Here it is. "It's a personal insult to conduct that kind of activity in a man's home, his castle. It cuts to the quick. It's brazen." That's the quote from Assistant State Attorney Chris Moody in the trial of Ralph Wald, age 70. Oh, he goes on. He goes on to say, "That kind of deep and personal insult, when you find another man having sex in your living room with Wald's wife, and you can't, because Wald has erectile difficulties, would make you want to lash out too. And he did." Yet the jury in the Tampa, Florida trial of Wald found him not guilty of second-degree murder for twice shooting the man having sex with his 41-year-old wife, killing him. Yes, you heard the math there. Ralph is 70, wife is 41. By the way, the victim, who Wald said he didn't recognize, was Walter Conley, age 35, his wife's former boyfriend, who lived nearby on, wait for it, Lover's Lane, and thought his wife was being raped, so that's why he shot the ex-boyfriend dead. Wald's wife, Joanna Lynn Flores, says she was drunk. And she said, once the jury returned its verdict, she and her husband were going out to celebrate. Because my husband puts me first, she said. He's taking me to the Waffle House. Oh, this is a woman with dreams, huh? Yeah, that's fancy. And by the way, I hope Joanna realizes the Waffle House doesn't serve alcohol. Yeah. Moving right along, bringing an arm home from war as a souvenir, now that's weird. Returning it to the man you took it from 47 years later, that's downright bizarre. But that is exactly what an American doctor did when he looked up the North Vietnamese soldier he operated on nearly a half a century earlier. In 1966, Dr. Sam Axelrad was a 27-year-old medical doctor serving in Vietnam when Nguyen Quang Hung was brought in to his table with a three-day-old wound to his arm. In order to save his life, Dr. Axelrad amputated the arm above the elbow. Now, Axelrad said his medic colleagues boiled off the flesh, reconstructed the arm bones, and gave it to him. It was hardly common practice, but he said it was a reminder of a good deed performed. When Axelrad finally looked through his war mementos all those years later in his Texas home, he was motivated to find out if the soldier was still alive. As it turns out, he was alive and well, so the good doctor packed the arm and decided to take his entire family on vacation to Vietnam. Nguyen was surprised to be reunited with his lost limb, to say the least. I can't believe that an American doctor took my infected arm, got rid of the flesh, dried it, took it home, and kept it for more than 40 years, he said. I don't think it's the kind of keepsake that most people would want to own, but I look forward to seeing him again and getting my arm bones back. The men were reunited at Nguyen's home in central Vietnam. They met each other's children and grandchildren and joked about which of them had been better looking back when war made them enemies. Well, talk about going out on a limb. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Tim Blackburn, age 50, fell off of a ladder in Stockton-on-Tees, England, back in 2007, and shattered his arm so badly that doctors had to remove 4 inches of bone and attach a metal scaffold around his arm that took 6 years to heal completely. And then only because of help from a cutting-edge ultrasound procedure. Well, in May of 2013, one day after he got a clean bill of health, Blackburn tripped over his dog and tumbled down the stairs in his home, and his arm snapped like a twig, he said. Yeah, bet you that dog is stuffed and mounted somewhere now, huh? Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Summer's here, which means more parties, barbecues, and perhaps even more work get-togethers. What does it mean for someone who is already struggling with drug and alcohol issues? On the line with us right now is Lorelei Rosano, who is the author of Jagged Little Edges and Grace's Secret. She's also a former addict who is now a family counselor, and she joins us on the line from British Columbia. Hi, Lorelei.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So is this a more difficult time of the year for people who have addiction issues than, say, perhaps the Christmas holidays?
Well, I think Christmas holidays or summer are probably both equally difficult in that, some of the alcohol is a little more visible. It wouldn't be unusual to go to the beach and see a cooler full of beer or, you know, barbecue and wine and that sort of thing. So I think they're probably both equally as difficult for someone newly recovering.
So what is the message you want to get out? Is it the situation where we're too lackadaisical on the whole idea of using alcohol or the way media portrays the use of alcohol or what?
You know, I don't think alcohol is the bad guy here. I mean, there's lots of folks who can drink and then there's some who can't, like me. Addiction affects 1 out of 10. But if you took that ratio, that's pretty much everyone. Almost everyone knows someone suffering the effects from addiction, whether it's a person or a family member who loves someone. I don't want to make alcohol the bad guy here because I don't think alcohol is the bad guy, but there are some people who shouldn't be drinking it, me for one. So I think what we want to start doing is having those conversations. It's interesting when we think about alcoholics and addicts, and I don't know about you, Pete, but I always imagine them in brown trench coats holding paper bags, kind of on skid row curled up in a corner somewhere. And, of course, that isn't what they look like at all. They look like you and I and our teachers and lawyers and doctors and surgeons and our neighbors and our children and our parents.
Well, what you described with the brown paper bag on Skid Row is the non-functioning alcoholic as opposed to the very functioning alcoholic who are all through society, correct?
Exactly, and most alcoholics are very functioning. I guess unless you want to talk about the word really functioning, what does it mean? They're white knuckling the ability to still maintain a queer household and a semblance of family until they can get the next drink in them. But you know, in order to move away from really having a disease, if you will, is starting to look at having conversations, asking for help, not leaving in isolation and secrecy, and sort of moving forward into openness and transparency. And so these are what I'm hoping we can do with these talks, you know, is perhaps, get the message out that there is no shame in becoming well. And if you think you have a problem with alcohol, if you've ever had that thought, chances are you probably do. And the thing with addiction is it is progressive. And so, you know, over the years, it gets progressively worse. Just like we were talking about those folks, you know, curled up on Skid Row. They didn't start out that way. Nobody does. So, and because it's progressive, eventually you're going to lose everything that you ever worked for, including your self-respect and dignity, you know, your family, your career, your home. And like any other illness, the sooner it's treated, the more successful the outcome. So, you know, addiction, I'd love to call it this, the conversation no one wants to have. Nobody wants to talk about it. And yet when we talk about it, shared is a problem solved. But with addiction, when we talk about the problem, it's a life saved. So hopefully, you know, me unmasking myself and taking kind of the covers off my own story encourages someone else to do that too.
Well, you're talking about having the conversation and people talking about it. Is it not a situation where we are talking about it more? And the reason why I bring that up, I grew up in the 60s where it seemed like no one talked about it. And it was quite the opposite, as a matter of fact, where people thought you were kind of a wuss if you didn't do those kind of things.
Absolutely. I can remember some pretty good house parties, not in the 60s, but certainly in the 70s. And I mean, it wasn't unusual at all. And strangely enough, I wasn't one of these people, so I didn't think I was alcoholic. But it wasn't unusual at all to see at least two or three people stumbling around slurring their words or someone passed out in a corner. You know, that was kind of what you quantified having a good time looking like. So, and that was just what we did every weekend in high school and as you go into college or whatever, that kind of stuff wasn't unusual at all. I don't remember anyone ever referring to that as a drinking problem or addiction. I think somewhere along the line, as we start to grow older, perhaps in our careers or raising families, we start to understand, okay, there's a problem here. That used to be so funny doesn't look particularly funny. I remember going to my 10-year reunion and seeing some of the folks, you know, we were still pretty young. Well, at our 25-year reunion, now some of the shenanigans going on in our 10-year didn't look quite as attractive. So at some point in our lives, we start to understand, okay, we've crossed the threshold from fun into kind of pathetic here. And so what do we do then and how do we begin those conversations?
Tell us a little bit about Jagged Little Edges. What is the point you're trying to make with your book? And also the website, which is jaggedlittleedges.com.
Yeah, well, Jagged Little Edges follows a 10-year journey into the throes of addiction and back, and it really describes the progression. I mean, what I'm trying to do is educate and support and give understanding to families and particularly young people. I remember being young and we were invincible and bulletproof and nothing bad could ever happen to you. And so I'm really trying to reach an audience here with one young woman's story, but you know, this, the main character, Lindsay, she could be your best friend, she could be your daughter, she could be your wife or lover, she could be, you know, your neighbor, she could be you. So there's something in this book that everybody's going to relate to for sure, even if it's just remembering back when, you know, in some of their times. But again, it follows 10 years, and so it really does describe the progression and the thinking and the internal dialogue and kind of what goes on. So if anyone's ever wondered about it, this certainly takes the mystery from it. I call it fiction. It's the first in a series of three, Jagged Little Lies. The second novel is just being edited now. Although it is fiction, it's very much driven by my experience, personal and clinical, because I do work in an addictions treatment center. So that's mostly what it is, just trying to hope, share knowledge and hope and support and education for its readers. It I'm hearing it's a pretty good read, too. And then Gracie's Secret, the first book we did, my granddaughter and I actually did that together, and she colored all the pictures. And this is a perspective of what happens when you're a little girl growing up in a family. In this particular family, there was an awful lot of arguing, like perhaps there isn't any family from divorce or addiction or just, you know, a lot of arguing. This little girl develops a tummy ache and feels very bad, and of course she doesn't know that bad she's experienced is actually developing shame. So in my website, jaggedlittleedges.com, Emma, the illustrator, and myself have decided to make that book available free as a free download in hopes that any little child will have the opportunity to download that and read it or be read it and find their voice, you know, younger in life and not have to take that walk of shame, which will change their footprints in how they deal and the paths they cross. So we've really hoped to be able to give that, you know, as another tool for families who could use it.
They often say that someone who has an addiction, someone who's an alcoholic or a drug addict, has to hit rock bottom before they can change. Do you believe that?
Not always. That's a difficult question. If yes and no, and I'll explain that answer. If family's involved and there's any form of, say, for instance, so many times, you know, I work in a treatment center. I work at the Edgewood Treatment Center, and I'm on one of my jobs is answering calls. I work with all the families. And so I'll often hear families phone in, not so much the person, but the families are phoning in, and they'll say, you know, geez, my son, my daughter, my husband, my wife, whoever it is, has a drug or alcohol problem. We really need to get them help. And, you know, they're prepared to do anything. So when we've got families that are supporting addiction, you see, addiction can't thrive without an enabling system. And I know that sounds really strange, but it requires someone to shoulder the consequences and bear the responsibilities and clean up the mess in order for it to continue to progress. So if we've got families highly involved with their person and they're paying rent and paying the lawyer bills and bailing them out and doing things like that, we don't have to hit rock bottom for those folks. Those folks can actually get family program help, develop bottom lines, start to learn about healthy boundaries. And in their changing their behaviors, the addict or alcoholic has no other choice but to kind of become well. They've got nowhere else left to go. Mm. Now, sometimes we've already gone too far in addiction, and perhaps the family's tried to set those bottom lines, and the person, and by the way, this is the smallest population of all alcoholics and addicts, but there's a small percentage that'll say, I don't care, I'd rather live on the streets than give up my drinking.
Now, let me ask you this. Let me ask you this, because we just have about a minute. Did you have to hit rock bottom yourself?
I thought it was rock bottom, but I had nowhere else to go. Pete, my family left me. My boyfriend, who's now my husband, walked away. I'd lost my job. I'd lost my home. The only other option I had was to go into treatment, and because I needed a roof over my head, I agreed to do so. My plan was to stay 3 days and then leave, and thank God none of that happened.
People can read your story. They can get their book in fictionalized form, as you say. But the truth is right there within it. It's called Jagged Little Edges. People can also go to your website, jaggedlittleedges.com. And there's also the other book, Gracie's Secret, correct?
Absolutely, Pete.
Lorelei, I thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Lorelei Rosano, author of Jagged Little Edges. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0203, and you'll find links to Lorelei's site, plus also links to Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Driving through Canada recently, I spotted something I haven't seen in the United States in years, a full-size telephone booth. It reminded me of a true story I'd like to share with you now. Several years ago, two women were standing by a phone booth outside a store when a driver veered out of control and hit them. The driver was high on drugs and had never driven a car before. The women were seriously injured. Even though the driver was convicted of felonious assault, the women sued the telephone company instead. When the case went before a state appeals court, one of the judges ruled that holding the phone company liable defied common sense. If it could be sued, said the judge, so could hot dog vendors and owners of newspaper stands. But amazingly, the majority of judges disagreed and ruled against the phone company. Let's be fair. Phone booths are vanishing from America today mainly because of the rising use of cell phones, but lawsuits like this certainly haven't helped. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
You're listening to The Stuff File, now with 25% fewer calories. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of Serenade, plus we will indeed have an idiot of the day, but right now I've got a couple more Stuff File news stories to share with you here on The Stuff File program, which is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. The man who claimed the world's record for traveling the farthest distance on a zip line attached only by his hair was killed in April as he similarly tried to attempt the same thing, that is crossing the Teesta River in West Bengal, India, on a zip line. Now, he died of a heart attack, and since observers were unclear whether his limpness was part of his performance, he hung lifeless for about 45 minutes. He was identified in news reports as a Guinness Book record holder, but as with many such claims, the Guinness Book has no such category. How about starting a new Guinness Book record just for him? How about this? Longest amount of time swinging from a zip line, dead. Bet nobody's going to try and beat that one. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest, a 22-year-old man was killed in March attempting to rope swing from the picturesque 140-foot-high Corona Arch near Moab, Utah, trying to emulate a famous 2012 internet video at the arch called World's Largest Rope Swing. Now, this man, however, apparently overestimated the length of rope that he would need to launch himself off the arch to begin his swing, and crashed to the ground. Yes, let's just anoint him the winner of this year's Wile E. Coyote Award and move on. On to our final guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Carol Jean Delmar is a Los Angeles-based author and opera critic. She has written Serenade, which is a memoir of her parents' lives that begins in 1922 Vienna and continues through the Holocaust era. Carol Jean joins us on the line right now from L.A. to share some of her parents' story. Hi, Carol Jean.
Hello.
Thanks for being on the program with us. You know, we're living in a time right now where it just seems a few things are coming out dealing with that Holocaust era. I've done some interviews with people talking about other situations that go back to that time. Is it a situation where we've reached a point that, unfortunately, because some of the people who have survived this have since passed away, that we need to get these stories out so that we never forget that time period?
Oh, absolutely. Being the daughter of Holocaust survivors and having written this book, which is a love story, really, about my parents, but describes their trials and tribulations and struggles during the Holocaust era, I believe stronger than ever in my life that I want to bring to light the events that occurred during the Holocaust so that we never forget.
Now, your father was an operatic singer himself, correct?
Yes. The story begins in 1927 when my parents meet, and I describe in the book the really beautiful aspects of Vienna, Austria. It's a city of music. And so it was just so glorious for him to be able to sing in the city of the Wiener Staatsoper, the Musikverein, and all of that. And I depict that in the book. But then he's singing in Prague, and it gets rather close to the Holocaust because Hitler takes over Austria, which is called the Anschluss. And my mother, who had a Czech passport, flees on that very day to be with my father in Prague. So that's the beginning of the Anschluss and the part that is not so pretty anymore. And I describe her ride in the train to get to Prague to safety.
Now, your parents were lucky enough to get out before a lot of the horrific tragedies that took place in that area took place during the Holocaust, but that they didn't go without hardships of their own, correct?
They had hardships, but I would say that my father's voice actually saved his life.
How so?
Because he was not in Vienna, at the time when later it came out from my grandmother that the Nazis had come looking for him in Vienna. And in my book, I do have a letter that was given to me from my cousin of my great aunt, who was deported to Theresienstadt, and one of the other, there were six sisters, and one of the other sister and her husband, and they were killed in Theresienstadt. And one was deported to Treblinka and was killed there. That's all in my book. I have 100 illustrations of documents that show my parents' passports with the J on them. And for women, they wrote Sarah above their names. And for men, they wrote Israel. So my parents were always frightened. My father sang for the Gauleiter, which was the leader of the Nazis in the Sudetenland, which was on the border of the Czech Republic, Czechoslovakia then, and Germany. He sang Dr. Bartolo when there was fear that the Germans were coming over the border. It was the last performance in what was called Aussig, and there are pictures of him singing Dr. Bartolo in April 1938. And as I said, he sang for the Gauleiter, Konrad Henlein. So he was always frightened, and my parents got married in Prague at the time of a mobilization of the troops. So it was very frightening, and my father audiotaped. He put everything on tape for me, and I went to Vienna and Prague and all over. They fled on a ship called the Rialto that took them via Zurich, then Milan, and it left from Geneva. And then they ended up going to Venezuela, where my father sang, and Panama, and they finally ended up in Havana, Cuba. So their type of Holocaust occurred in Havana, Cuba, when they had quota numbers that suddenly, when they went to the embassy there, were not registered, and it was very difficult for them to get the quota numbers back, which meant they couldn't enter the United States. And they were put in this camp called Triskornia, which there was poor conditions, very little food. Children were getting sick, babies, and they didn't know how to get out. And the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society had a representative standing behind the barbed wire fence, and they would go and talk to him every day until they could virtually buy themselves out of Triskornia. And this went on for years. People were sequestered there against their will for years. So my parents did live a type of different Holocaust. My father lost his voice in Havana. Nobody really knows why for sure. It was not for lack of solid technique. And he went to doctors once in the United States, and his voice could not be revived. So his voice saved his life. But then he had to start all over again in the United States from square one.
Well, let me ask you this. Let me ask you this, Carol Jean. You have this situation where you decided to write this book, Serenade. Mm-hmm. When did you decide to start to do this?
This book has been a long time in the works. I started it in 1998. My mother had passed away, and I, having been a journalist, and I freelanced for the LA Times. I was a staff writer for the Los Angeles Daily News. I wanted to try a different type of writing, and I wanted to tell a love story. And I wasn't creative, actually, in that area, so I thought my parents had the most beautiful love story that anyone could possibly have. And I decided I wanted to write a love story about them. And I started to research it. My dad audiotaped his whole life story, things I never knew about my parents. And then I decided to travel. So I traveled to every single city, including Havana. I went to Vienna and Prague, Milan, Geneva, all of them, Zurich, Panama, Venezuela, and Cuba. And I would come back and I would write. My father was still alive, and I would write and I would read him the chapters, and this continued on. And then I was not able to get it published at a certain period in about the year 2000. It took me till 2000 to write it, and so I put it away. It actually started off as a novel. And I put it away knowing that it had to be published. And then a couple of years ago, I decided, no, I want to make it a real memoir because I miss my parents so much. And so I did fact-finding. I called the archivists in where Aussig is, which is now Usti Nad Labem. I found out my dad was singing Sauberflöte in the novel, which is the magic flute. He really sang Dr. Bartolo and the Barber of Seville. So I rewrote chapters to make it absolutely accurate. And I wrote the story of their lives. And now I've been able to publish it. And I could have never done this 12 years ago. I have 100 illustrations, their passports, the ships they took, my father's singing, how he reinvented himself in the United States. He became first a costumer on movies like The Ten Commandments. I have pictures of him in on location in Egypt in The Ten Commandments. He won for best costumer for a television show for The Untouchables. I have a picture of him with the award and after Robert Stack.
Well, let me ask you this. Carol Jean.
I could have never done it. Now I could.
Let me ask you this, Carol Jean. I mean, we all love our parents for being mm-hmm. our parents. But you've had that extra situation where you've done this research and put together this book. In doing that, what's the most important thing you learned about your parents that you didn't know?
Oh, I think I learned so much about my parents, but I think what it did for me, it changed doing the research and going to the various countries, changed my life, and I can't quite explain it, and how I feel about who I am and my heritage. That's why I do want to stress and speak at Holocaust museums and in front of the Jewish community, because they changed my life. I started writing opera reviews. I'm a true opera buff. I started writing opera reviews, and I used the opera and the lyricism of the leader and the opera to create the love story. To me, it was my key to being able to write in a poetic fashion. But learning about my parents, I learned many things about them to be respected, and I learned what they lost and what they went through, which they hid from me. And I've heard this from other children of Holocaust survivors. They hid from me these struggles. They wanted me to grow up to be an American and not to feel burdened or that they had suffered. And so they hid everything from me. And it isn't until I traveled that I really learned what happened, got more interested in other Holocaust survivors, and now feel a sense of community with people who are children and Holocaust survivors. Mm. It's a whole different feeling inside my, if you want to call it my gut.
Right. Well, Carol Jean, one thing that a lot of people always want in their lives is to know that their parents are in some way, shape, or form proud of them. And I'm sure that your parents would be proud of the work you put together with the book Serenade. I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Well, I'm so glad that you had me. Thank you so very much for letting me share this wonderful story with you and share my love for my parents with you.
Carol Jean Delmar, author of Serenade. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is 0203, and you'll find links to Carol Jean's site, plus also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Police credited a questionable fashion decision by an alleged carjacker for his quick capture. That and a bad decision he made while trying to elude police. 20-year-old Elijah Freeman stole a car at gunpoint in Clayton County, Georgia. After a short police chase, police say he crashed the stolen car on the front lawn of the Clayton County Police Headquarters. Freeman then took off running, but was unable to run well because he was wearing what a popular song called Pants on the Ground. With his pants falling toward his knees, police were able to capture the fleeing Freeman within seconds. As the suspect sat in the patrol car wearing only his boxer shorts and a t-shirt, an investigator examined the suspect's falling pants, crumpled on the ground nearby. An investigator said two baggy pants have given law enforcement an advantage. I have found in my experience it's very helpful to law enforcement to chase suspects struggling with their falling pants, said Major Kevin Roberts of the Clayton PD. It's to our benefit. Yes. Well, you know, if you're going to commit a crime, why would you attempt to do it in ill-fitting clothing? Well, one reason, and one reason only. You're a mouth-breathing, pant-dragging, fashion felony idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0203. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links to all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0203. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. A tape of the preceding program will be sent to the Radio Hall of Fame, where it will be placed under the statue of Marconi, which is kind of wobbly.